Good afternoon, it's 3 o'clock and you are tuned to KTUO News in Juneau here on Wednesday, the 12th of October, the year 2011. Jeff Brown with you here on a Juneau afternoon. Today we'll talk with Aaron Elmore and Katie Jensen about the theater and the office production of The Midsummer Night's Dream. Elizabeth Dubofsky and Sarah Lewis will be here to highlight this week's Slow Food Potluck and the showing of the film Ingredients coming up next month. We'll also talk about the extended run of Perseverance Theater's play The 39 Steps, and we'll find out more about favorite movies of Junoites with guests Clint Farr and Pat Race. That right is Almanac Music and more today on a Juneau afternoon. The forecast for tonight looks like rain showers with low temperatures around 42 degrees and light winds. Forecast for Thursday, numerous rain showers, high temperatures around 47 degrees.
Native Voice One, the Native American Radio Service.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. A long-awaited inquiry into the police handling of a serial killer case in British Columbia, Canada, began Tuesday. As Dan Karpinchuk reports, many of the victims were Aboriginal women.
The British Columbia Missing Women Commission of Inquiry will look at why it took police so long to admit there was a serial killer targeting women in Vancouver's downtown east side. Many of the families of the victims believe the police were negligent, allowing Robert Picton to get away with murder for more than 5 years. Picton was arrested in 2002 and was eventually convicted of 6 murders, but while in jail he boasted of killing as many as 49 women. His victims were usually drug-addicted sex trade workers, many of whom were Aboriginal. Day one of the inquiry began with an Aboriginal blessing from Squamish First Nation elder Eugene Harry.
I ask the Lord for a special blessing on each and everyone's mind today. We give thanks. The blanket that's wrapped around our elder here, our chief, is a love offering to thank him for the work he's doing, carrying on the spirit, holding the spirits and the thoughts of the ones that are gone.
As the hearings got underway, chants and drums from dozens of protesters gathered outside could be heard. They were angry over the government's decision not to pay the cost for more than a dozen advocacy groups that were granted standing at the hearings. The latest to bow out was the Assembly of First Nations, and the head of the Union of BC Indian Chiefs, Stuart Phillip, said his group has no faith in the integrity of this inquiry process. For National Native News, I'm Dan Karpinchuk.
More than 100 tribal leaders are descending on the nation's capital this week to lobby the government to address needs in Indian country. Matt Laszlo reports from Washington, D.C.
Every budget item is on the table as the Congressional Super Committee looks to slash more than $1 trillion from the federal budget. That has tribes worried that services their people depend on may get cut, including medical services, broadband development, and potentially road projects. Jefferson Keel, president of the National Congress of American Indians, says tribes need to combine their voices to demand government leaders start consulting with tribal leaders before they start cutting services.
Historically, not occurred in Indian country. That's what we need. And we need to bring that to the president. Hopefully, we'll have a summit this year in Washington, D.C.
Lawmakers on the Senate Indian Affairs Committee are vowing to support tribal leaders in the budget debate. But Wyoming Republican John Barrasso told the group it's vital that Native Americans make their voices heard so officials know what budget items to protect, because cuts are coming.
In the midst of this historic recession, it is especially important that we hear from you and how we can best use resources.
Tribal leaders are taking their priorities to lawmakers on Capitol Hill and officials in the White House through the rest of the week. For National Native News, I'm Matt Laszlo.
The Cherokee Nation Election Commission releases unofficial results in the special election for principal chief following 3 days of counting. The new leader received more than 50% of the vote. As Kirk Gortney reports, after a troubled election, the leader is asking for healing.
Longtime Cherokee Tribal Council member Bill John Baker has defeated incumbent Chad Smith in the race to lead the Oklahoma-based tribe. Unofficial results announced late Tuesday are expected to be certified within 48 hours. The first round of voting was in June, but that election was so close that each candidate was declared the winner twice, and the Tribal Supreme Court ordered another round of voting. The special election included votes from the descendants of slaves once owned by members of the Cherokee tribe, despite ongoing legal action questioning their tribal citizenship. Baker called on the nearly 300,000 members of the Cherokee Nation to come together and fight to solve its people's problems instead of each other. For National Native News, I'm Kurt Gwartney in Norman, Oklahoma.
On this day in 1913, Benny Benson was born in Alaska. At 13, he designed the Alaska flag with 8 gold stars on a field of blue. The flag depicts the Big Dipper and the North Star. This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
National Native News is produced at the Annenberg National Native Voice Studios in Albuquerque, New Mexico by Kiwanis Broadcast Corporation, with offices in Anchorage, Alaska. Funding is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the Annenberg Foundation, and the Ford Foundation. With funding by the Washington, D.C. and Alaska law firm of Sanosky, Chambers, Saxe, Miller, and Munson, defending Native American interests throughout the United States. Native Voice One, the Native American Radio Service.
Time is 3:05 and you are tuned to KTOO News in Juneau here on a Juneau afternoon. First guests are Katie Jensen and Aaron Elmore from Theater in the Rough here to talk about their production of a Midsummer Night's Dream coming up this weekend. Katie and Aaron, thank you for coming down to the station today.
Good afternoon, Jeff.
Good afternoon. So this is a momentous occasion for you, 20 years after you founded the...
Can't quite fathom how 2 decades can slip by, but yes, 20 years ago in the old McFeeters Hall, we did a Midsummer Night's Dream with a cast of about 12 people, and here we are today.
Any puppets in the play?
Yes, there are puppets in the play. Oh,
puppets and masks and dance. It's
puppets, masks, and dance. We've sort of taken everything we've learned in the past 20 years and kind of boiled it down to do this piece. It's a lot of fun.
This is the first presentation by Theater in the Rough that is written by Bill Shakespeare. Why did you pick it back then?
Back then, I picked it because it had become, over a period of about 10 years prior to that, one of my favorite plays, period. It's delightfully funny, incredibly silly at certain points, also very serious, very dear. It deals with all the issues that one could possibly want to deal with in a good comedy. It's about true love and about magic and about transformation and about people trying to make themselves better. And it does all that with tremendous grace, and it's very amusing along the way.
And the madness of love. How love drives you mad, drives you to do things you would not normally do.
And maybe you oughtn't to do, but...
And jealousy as well, so that's all wrapped up. And some of the most tragic moments are in his comedies, and some of the funniest moments are in his tragedies, and this is one that has an element of all of them. It's quite a beautiful piece.
It's interesting that both of you, you and Perseverance Theater and Theater, have chose comedies to start out your season with. Is there any particular reason for that? Is it... After a dreary September?
I didn't really check with them, but we'd wanted to do this piece. I think we'd long thought, well, maybe someday we'd do Midsummer again, but when the church burned down...
We chose this as we were watching the church burn. We chose this series of shows to do.
This was the one we wanted to... We really wanted to open the hall with our town last spring.
Right.
And then we thought, well, the first Shakespeare we do in there really should be Midsummer, since that was the first one we did way back when in the old hall.
How does this compare with other works of Shakespeare?
As a comedy, I would definitely say it's one of his most popular.
It is one of his most popular, but it's also one of his most mature, because he's got so many of the different elements. He's bringing quite serious moments in with quite funny, quite broad comic moments. But he's dealing with some fairly deep psychological turns that happen to people when they're in extreme situations, especially when they're impassioned in love, and the wrong choices that they make, and the wrong choices they make out of jealousy, and how they mishear each other. And it's one of his later comedies, and that's why it's so well-rounded. And the language is really beautiful, and it's really straight to the audience. It's quite crystal clear.
For those unfamiliar with the plot, could you go over it, please?
It's essentially the story of, I think it starts with a young woman who's had an arranged marriage set up for her, and she doesn't want to marry the boy that she's set up with. She wants to marry someone she really loves. It's certainly not the oldest story in the world, but it might be close to it. And from there, things sort of spiral out of control. The boy that she's supposed to marry at one time was in love with somebody else. So between these four lovers, they've got their whole story going on. In the midst of this, the leader of the country, Duke Theseus, is trying to set up a beautiful gala wedding with his new wife, a woman he's been at war with, actually, over a number of years, and finally they've made peace, and they're going to marry, to sort of unite their countries. Well, what we find out in the course of our production, anyway, is that they're actually deeply in love with one another in the midst of all that, very passionate about one another. And so there's multiple love stories kind of working along with this thing. Percolating underneath all of these stories is a group of common laborers who want to do something nice for the Duke for his wedding day. They decide they're going to put on a play. Well, of course, the resonances between this tiny amateur company and our tiny amateur company are too numerous and hard-hitting to probably list in 5 or 10 minutes, but it's a lot of fun to watch them sort of come to life in the course of the play. All of these stories crash together in the woods outside of town, in the dark of night, on a midsummer's night. And in the midst of that, all of these characters also encounter a group of, well, the fairy king and queen, Titania and Oberon, who are out there in the woods fighting amongst themselves. Because of their fighting, of course, the seasons have altered and the plants aren't coming up correctly and there's disease and dreadful things going on. And Titania wants Oberon to make up with her so that everything can go all right again. And in the course of the play, they get it all worked out. But it's there's a couple of...
It makes some bad choices along the way.
They make some bad choices along the way, which is a lot of fun to watch.
That's where it becomes funny.
Yeah.
How have you revised the play?
Well, what I think one of the main things we did this time was to set Katie to creating us a dance. We learned so much about dance and Trojan women probably 10 years ago now. And then in Cyrano, just a year ago, we reintroduced that as a way of telling stories, as a way to take an existing text and sort of open it up in a new way, engaging it with music, and the audience is able to apprehend things in a brand new dimension. That was just too much fun, I think, essentially.
And we have a cast that has that ability now. We have some trained dancers, some untrained dancers, and also trained and untrained puppeteers, but they're quite skilled, so that we wanted to take advantage of that. And there's just something through the language of dance and the language of music that transcends the words, so it's just backing up the story and opening it up a little bit more emotionally, because music is such an instant connection into the human soul, and to have a body move to it, you can express things that way that you can't normally through words.
Another thing that we found has sort of become our deal these days is trying to get younger performers and younger artists into a position where they can do this in front of a real audience. And Katie's sort of been mentoring Denise Gott here for a number of years in dance, mm-hmm. and they've been helping each other. And so they've worked together on a lot of these dances, and Donnie's actually been able to choreograph one of the numbers herself, a number of the numbers herself.
Yeah.
It's been a tremendous thing for her. She's going even further down the road. Bless her heart. She's going to be directing The Lion in Winter here coming in the spring. Katie and I will both be in it, but we won't...
We're training her to become a director.
It's a tremendous opportunity
for
us.
She's got a great gift for it.
Yes, she does, and she's going to be. It's going to be a great, great thing. She's also playing Puck in this production. So, of course, as usual, there's another ruffian thing. Everybody's wearing a bunch of different hats, but we have an opportunity to work with some extremely young actors again, and that's always tremendous and always amazing. You learn things, and they, of course, have an opportunity to learn things as well, find out what this craft is and how to invest in it further. And once again, quite almost by surprise, it certainly wasn't by design, we just were looking for the right people for the parts and the people who were interested, and we gathered up this cast of 12 people, and 25% of them are underage. So for us, it's a tremendous opportunity to get to sort of form them in the beginning of this vocation of theirs.
And should I mention the names of the actors involved?
Absolutely. Again, thinking of way back when, 20 years ago, there were three of us who were actually in the original production. Mm-hmm. Katie and I both mm-hmm. were. I played Bottom in the original production. I'll be doing that again, playing a loudmouth actor. That's typecasting works over and over again. Katie played Puck in the original production. She's playing Hippolyta and Titania. She's playing two parts, the two queens, essentially. And opposite her, playing the two kings, Duke Theseus, and Oberon, King of the Fairies, is Eddie Jones, back after Back Through Time and Space to play those two parts again.
And so he was in the original production.
Yeah. So between the three of us, we've got that sort of going on. And then we have other folks who've worked with us for years and years now. Becky Orford, Denise Goff, of course, Megan Behnke. And then we've got a bunch of folks who have been with us in more of the shorter term, and it's been wonderful to sort of form them up. Carl Broderson's back again. I think this is his third show now. Becca Gagin was in Cyrano last year. She's back in this. And Natalia Spangler, who was also in Our Town last year. And there's a number of folks who've not worked with before. It's a great, always great opportunity. Fisher Stevens, whose father, Ray Stevens, worked over at Perseverance for many, many years.
Mm-hmm.
And sort of carrying that sort of generational torch forward as an actor, which is a lot of fun. Ariana Orford, speaking of generational torches, Becky's daughter is in this production, and Ben Crowell as well. So, you know, a great range of ages and a tremendous group of people. Couldn't ask for a better bunch.
I'm talking with Aaron Elmore and Katie Jensen about the Theater in the Rough's presentation of A Midsummer Night's Dream, which opens up this weekend.
It opens this Friday, yes. It will be a free preview on Thursday night, tomorrow night, and then we open Friday night. Both of those are at 7:30. We'll run another one on Saturday night, 7:30. And then we'll be back next weekend with a pay-as-you-will on Thursday night, and then two shows Friday and Saturday night. And then two weekends after that, Thursday, Friday, Saturday, with Sunday matinees at 2 o'clock. And then on November 18th, yes, that's right, we go to Petersburg, of all places in the world. They called us down. They wanted us to come do a play. So we're taking the Midsummer Night's Dream on the road, or on the Marine Highway, I guess is a better way to put it.
Well, a number of interviews ago, we talked a little bit about off-air primarily, but some little bit on the air about the magic that one creates in a live theater presentation versus seeing it on TV or not going at all and sitting at home and reading a book, perhaps.
Yeah, it's a brave thing to do, I think. First of all, the actors do this every single night. They come out. They don't stay at home and do their own thing. They gather up with a group of people and sort of strip themselves bare and emotionally and perform and learn lines and dedicate themselves to this craft. And for the audience to come out and watch this is yet an even larger act of bravery, because when the audience arrives, of course, that's when the magic starts to happen.
It's fun. They're the third character. They're the other... It's an exchange. That's the thing that's fantastic about live theater, is the audience doesn't realize we can hear you, we can see you, and you're part of this. So I think that is why theater survives, is because people crave that kind of contact when there's no screen or there's no airwaves between them. They're in the same room with something that's actually happening.
And there's us up there asking them to believe in this magic. And that is everything, because a willing audience does. And if, you know, what they're seeing is true, and that's always what we're trying to do, is create truth, they go right along with it. That's lovely.
Now that you've inspired all these people to go out and buy tickets, where can they get them?
They can get them at the Jack right across the road here. They can get them at Hearthside Books in both locations, and they can also get them at the door.
But do get them early. We have a smaller house now. Yeah, the theater doesn't have as many seats as it used to have.
So seating will
don't
be
wait till
limited.
The last minute.
But it's a new house for a lot of people.
Yeah, the new McPheeters Hall. Seating way up high, looking down. Got a curtain that opens and shuts now. It's
real
really
chairs, no benches.
Fantastic.
All right, Katie Jensen and Aaron Elmore, thank you for coming down the station today. Talk about A Midsummer Night's Dream opening this Friday at the McPheeters Hall at the corner of 4th and Gold, downtown Juneau.
Thanks.
Thanks, Jeff.
Shining bright above you, night breezes seem to whisper, I love you. Birds singing in the sycamore tree, dream a little dream of me. Say nighty night and kiss me, just hold me tight and tell me me while I'm alone and blue as can be. Dream a little dream of me. Your dream.
time is 3:20, and you are tuned to KTUO News in Juneau here on a Juneau afternoon. Our next guest is Elizabeth Dubovsky from the Slow Food Workshop. They're talking about a potluck and a series of workshops coming up. Elizabeth, thank you very much for coming down to the station today.
Thanks for having me.
So for people who are just tuning in, what is slow food?
Slow food, sort of as the name Slow Food suggests, it's an international food movement that started about 20 years ago in response to the rise in fast food chains all over the world. And so since then, it's really evolved into just thousands and thousands of members in over 100 countries around the world, including chapters here in Southeast Alaska, where we are working to promote good, clean, and fair food, and really to increase the accessibility of food that is good, clean, and fair. And, you know, I think that's the most important part of Slow Food and what it's about. It's ensuring that everyone has access, equal and fair access to food that's good for them and delicious and sustainable. You know, here in Southeast Alaska, I think we're really unique within the bigger slow food movement because for us, increasing access to good and healthy food, I think, is more about growing your own food, foraging for it, harvesting it, hunting, fishing, all these things we have right here in our backyard. And so within our group, we often refer to it as sort of do-it-yourself food, you know, really getting out there in the woods or on the water and producing that food yourself and processing it. So we really try to increase just awareness about how to do that, where to do that, and provide tools for local residents so they can also have access to good, clean, and fair food that's right in our backyard.
Are you having a potluck soon?
We are. So we typically have quarterly meetings for all members, and even if you're not a member, all are welcome to join us. And our fall meeting happens tomorrow evening at 6:30 p.m. The potluck starts, and it's going to be out at Pavitt's Health and Fitness up in their upstairs classroom. So come at 6:30, bring a dish if you want, maybe something inspired by the fall season and the rain and sort of cozy foods out there. And around 7 o'clock or so, we'll start our workshop and discussion, which is going to focus on hunting for slow food. We've got a couple local experts coming in to talk about just the basics of hunting, the ethics of hunting, which I think is something most people don't really think about. And then also once you have, let's say, your deer, you know, when you cut it apart, what are the different cuts of meat and how do you cook those different cuts of meat? I know I've been handed, you know, a tenderloin or a roast from a friend who's got extra venison, and I never know, like, what's the best way to prepare the certain cut. So they'll go over that. There'll also be some resources available for people to take home on canning venison and game meat, how to make jerky from game meat as well, and just sort of what to do with all that meat once you have it. So that's tomorrow night, Thursday at 6:30 p.m. at Pavitt's.
And you also have a series of workshops coming up?
We'll have a series of food films being shown at Gold Town Nickelodeon, and those will start the first week of November. Gold Town's really helping us get out some of these really fun food films being released. We're going to start with the film Ingredients, which I think it'll be tentatively for November 2nd. Stay tuned to the Gold Town Nickelodeon website for time and details on that. We'll also post information on the Slow Food Southeast Alaska Facebook page on that food film series. It'll be every other week we'll show a food film there, so start first week in November running through mid-December.
Do you have a favorite slow food?
Favorite slow food? It's hard to say. I think for me, I love especially fall baked apples. I know our apples are not local, but sort of letting an apple slowly cook in the oven with a little cinnamon, maybe some nutmeg. It's just a very simple food that costs a few cents, but I think it's one of the more satisfying meals out there. And, you know, of course, nothing beats homemade pie as well.
I've been talking with Elizabeth Dubovsky about the slow food movement and the potluck coming up tomorrow night at the Pavitt Health and Fitness, and that starts again at 6:30.
Correct, yeah, and we'll run till about 9 o'clock, so come anytime within there.
All right, Elizabeth, anything you'd like to add I might have forgotten to ask?
No, that's it.
And thanks for coming by.
Thank you.
Hey, those guys are good at broccoli playing. Come on, honey. Oh, now listen. We've listened to these songs a million times. Let's give the fruit guys a chance.
In the morning.
Come on. All right. Thank you. Thank you.
Group of people called the Wild Man. They play fruits and vegetables. We were just hearing the yam, the broccoli bone, the sliced potato, and the rutabaga, and the washed tub bass. We called the Wild Man again from their CD called the Wild Man. Time is 3:27. You are tuned to KTOO News in Juneau. A brief sad note: Barbara Kalin, longtime music fixture in Southeast Alaska, passed away last night in her sleep, and is a peaceful, tragic. It was a peaceful ending, and Barbara, we will miss you.
And here is the Writer's Almanac for Wednesday. It's the 12th of October, 2011. It was on this day, 1892, the Pledge of Allegiance was recited en masse, first time, more than 2 million students. It had been written just a month before by a Baptist minister named Francis Bellamy, published it in a magazine, Youth's Companion, and distributed it across the country. It was a little bit shorter in 1892. I pledge allegiance to my flag and the republic for which it stands, one nation, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all. It was revised to read the flag of the United States of America in 1923, and then the words under God were added in 1954. Under God was added because President Dwight D. Eisenhower had attended a sermon by the Reverend George Dougherty, who said that apart from the mention of the United States of America, it could be a pledge of any republic. In fact, he could hear little Moscow children repeating a similar pledge to the hammer and sickle flag in Moscow. And so Eisenhower was convinced, and within a few months they included the words under God as a way to distinguish this Pledge of Allegiance from one in the Soviet Union. It's the birthday of the poet and translator Robert Fitzgerald, born Springfield, Illinois, 1910. He went off to the Choate School in Connecticut when he was a young man, met the classics teacher and translator Dudley Fitz, was so impressed by him, he went to Harvard because Fitz had gone there. Eventually became a beloved professor there, translated the Odyssey, the Iliad, the Aeneid, had a wide circle of literary friends, including Robert Lowell, and it was Lowell who introduced Robert Fitzgerald and his wife Sally to a young writer, a Catholic writer named Flannery O'Connor, who came to live with the Fitzgeralds in Connecticut for almost 2 years, working on a novel. After she left, she wrote to the Fitzgeralds, who were expecting a baby. She wrote, "I hope this one will be a girl and have a fierce Old Testament name and cut off a lot of heads. You had better stay down and take care of yourself. Your children sound big enough to do all the work. By beating them moderately and moderately often, you should be able to get them in the habit of doing domestic chores. Here's a poem for today by Julie Cadwallader-Staub, entitled If Life Were Like Touch Football. Driving north on Route 2A from Vermont to Maine, listening to the news, the New England Patriots coach was caught trying to videotape the hand signals of the New York Giants. I remember how we six sisters would recruit a few boys from the neighborhood for a pickup game of touch football in the street, how we'd break into teams, huddle around whomever was chosen to be quarterback, how the quarterback would extend her left palm flat into the middle of the huddle, plant the index finger of her right hand in the center of her palm, and then with finger motions and whispers, she would diagram who was to go where and when in order to so confuse and fool the other team that one of us could break free and go long. Oh, that feeling of running as fast as I could, extending my arms, my hands, my fingers as far as I could, watching that spiraling bullet of a football, reminding myself, if you can touch it, you can catch it. If you can touch it, you can catch it. If Life Were Like Touch Football, a poem by Julie Cadwallader-Staub from her collection Face to Face, published by Dream Seeker Books and used by permission here on the Writer's Almanac. Supported by the Poetry Foundation, where your mobile device can turn into a virtual poetry library with the Poetry Foundation's Poetry app. You can find it online at poetryfoundation.org. And by CSX, transporting 2 billion pounds of goods to market by train and working to help move the economy forward. CSX, How Tomorrow Moves. Edited by Noah Smith and written by Betsy Allister. Be well, do good work, and keep in touch.
Time is 3:33, and you are tuned to KTOO News in Juneau here on a Juneau afternoon. Our next guests are here involved with the Perseverance Theater's production of The 39 Steps. You're a designer. You directed. You didn't direct it this time. What did you design?
I designed the lighting this time, Jeff.
And even lighting, and Riley Woodford designed the sound, and Valerie Snyder designed the costumes. Thank you very much for coming on the station.
Thanks for having us, Jeff.
Thanks for having us.
So, briefly, a little bit about the plot. We've discussed this a couple of times on the air before, but for people who didn't catch that play.
Yeah, The 39 Steps was originally a novel. It was published in 1915, and it was the first penny spy thriller novel. It sort of invented that genre. And then Alfred Hitchcock adapted the novel into a film in the 30s, and it was one of his early great successes as a spy thriller movie.
It was British.
Yeah.
In Britain.
It's when he was still making films in England before he came to Hollywood. Really, really great story, and it's got a lot of the classics of the genre. It's got the exotic woman from somewhere in Eastern Europe with a secret, and someone spiriting military secrets out of the country, and chases, and people in disguise, and all of that stuff is kind of began with that book, and then Hitchcock perfected it in the film. And then the play is a send-up of the movie. It's kind of a comic parody of the spy movie genre turned into a play. And that sounds like a lot of layers, and it is, but it works really, really beautifully on the stage.
So you're able to take a serious film and turn it into a comedy, and you did do it quite well, but how do you do it?
Well, there's a lot to make fun of, and the genre's become so familiar, you know, the spy genre, that there are sort of cliches about it that you can send up and people recognize them instantly, and that really helps.
And references to Hitchcock films and so on.
A lot of references to Hitchcock, yeah.
There's a lot of physical comedy. How much does the play owe to vaudeville?
A lot, I think. Yeah, a lot.
At times it seems like the actors are acting with the set as much as each other. How much of that, you know, came about in the rehearsal process through improvisation?
A fair amount, yeah. The set was designed in advance, but it's got a lot of flexibility with where the pieces go and how they're used. So the actors are a group that have worked together a lot before, so they were able to come up with ideas of how to use the pieces, especially things like, you know, how do we use this chair? How do we create this train out of these trunks, that sort of thing.
Or the window scene.
The window scene is a great classic. Example. Yeah, it's classic.
Yeah, that set is a prop. I mean, it's a bunch of props at the same time as a set.
Yeah.
I noticed there's a lot of layers in the play, much like a movie. There's just a little bit of hint of music there, and then it disappears, and a little effect of this sound effect. You're not hitting people over the head with the sound effect. You're using it kind of tastefully. How did you design the sound, Riley?
Well, it was started with the script, looking at where the script called for sound, but it might be pretty simple, like the sound of a train, sound of a guy jumping onto the roof of a train and then jumping off the train. That sounds pretty straightforward, but if you think about it, it involves, you know, the sound of a train, the sound of wind, the sound of the environment around it. Then you add action music to that. And so actually one thing I wanted to thank you for letting me come in here and use those BBC records, sound effects records, so I could get some kind of obscure sounds like a 30s era British police car siren, and then a lot of sounds I have. You know, I have lots of sounds that I've recorded of wind blowing or a river flowing by or things like that. And then I went up to the White Pass Railroad out of Skagway and recorded, got a ride on that from them, and recorded the train. So I had real train sounds, and then worked with that, building all those layers up together, and then putting music on it too. And it's interesting. Some of those sounds get built in a big pile and become a sound file or a big sound effect, but some of that also is done in the theater by the stage manager who's running it, because some things you want to have come in at different times or stop on a dime or in response to an actor. And so some things happen, some things are being done by the stage manager. So this is a big play for the stage manager to be running. She's got to be really on the ball, and she's turning stuff on and off and cueing sounds and turning them off and fading them out. And things like that throughout the whole play.
How many sound cues are there?
There's about 60 in the script, but there's probably over 250, maybe 200 to 250 all told, counting some of these things that might involve 5 or 10 sounds in one scene.
You talked about the train scene. One of the neat things that I was watching with my wife, the ability of the actors to make it look like the train was actually moving using their costumes. Valley, talk about designing the costumes if you could.
Yeah, in that scene in particular, they do the wind. They all flap their coats in each other's coats to make the wind go by. And they've done a great job in improvising with costumes that way. There's so many changes. Sometimes they only have a few seconds to put on a costume and turn into a completely different character, so we couldn't get into a lot of layers and makeup. It's just a hat and a beard, and off they go. They've been really good with the improvisation.
As a costume designer, do you have to do a lot of work, or you just kind of look in the prop department for the thing that looks kind of the best?
It's a lot of work. Yeah, there's a few dozen costumes in the show, and we try some things that don't work, so we try other things, and we have to make sure they don't wear out, so we have backup copies of some stuff. It's a lot, but it works with props. If somebody needs, say, a knife in the back, then props and I have to figure out that together. So.
How much costume repair have you had to do?
How much what?
Costume repair.
A fair amount in the early stages when we found out they need to knock over a chair and then drape themselves over it and this and that. But by opening night, I think we got the hang of it. We put the reinforcements in all the right spots.
For me, one of the most fun things about seeing the costume design come together is that there are two actors that play dozens and dozens of characters. There's also a couple, the leading man and the leading lady, that basically play themselves. But these two other guys play all the other characters in the Hitchcock film, and there's over 100 other characters in his film. Not all of them make it into the play, but it's these two guys. It's Roblin Gray Davis and Jed Hancock Brainerd play dozens of different people, and they sometimes in the same scene are changing from the newspaper boy to the constable to the train conductor, using a costume piece to help signify who they are. And it's really good fun and a great collaboration between the costume design and the acting.
How many costumes did you have to come up with total?
I think I have 31 on paper, and I don't know how many more didn't make the paper. It was just, we need a Christmas tree. Go find it. There's a Christmas tree at the very end.
And a lot of it is just a hat change.
A lot of them are just hats, a couple of just beards and just bow ties. But they do a great job of turning that into a full character. And then whenever we had time, we tried to turn it like a Mrs. McGarrigle, the Scottish hotel owner, has...
it's one of my favorites.
Yeah, quite a few pieces, hair and padding, and she's great. And then they whip it all off and turn it into something else.
Right in front of the audience. Sometimes,
yeah. McGarrigle does too.
Mm-hmm. How much has the play changed since it opened?
A lot. This company, these four actors have worked together a lot before, and that's one of the reasons that they're in this. So they have a great sense of play, and playing, especially a comedy in front of an audience, you learn a lot about timing and what works. So it's really sharpened and become, I think, funnier in some places and tighter. It's really, really a joy to watch how it's evolved. Really,
it's much tighter. Yeah. It's just shorter. You know, it's just been tightened up.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And certainly the sound, doing, you know, all those rehearsals in an empty theater and then getting, 100 people in there, it's amazing how much sound people absorb, those bodies absorb. And across the board, everything just seemed too quiet all of a sudden. And so you've got that, just the physical presence of people absorbing a lot of sound and everything needs to be turned up, but then you've got people laughing on top of it. And then also the actors are making quite a bit of noise at times, pushing something across the stage that rolls or knocking stuff over. And so it's got to be, loud over that, but then you have actors doing lines too, and so you can't drown them out, but sometimes they need to really project. And so all that kind of got fine-tuned, and even just last night we went in and turned some things up and some things down and routed some sounds to certain speakers and not others, and we just got a big super bass woofer in there, and so that's great for things like the train where you can really make those low frequencies rumble.
Now, parts of the play are presented as if they're done in front of an audience with recorded applause. As an audience member, I was wondering, how often does the theater audience break that wall and applaud themselves?
Sometimes. Yeah, sometimes. And I was remembering that we added a lighting joke where each time the host asks a question, a light would come up on someone in the audience. And it was an idea we weren't sure was going to work. I remember watching it in the previews where people would ask and the audience, and then Mr. Memory would answer the question, and the audience member usually would give a thumbs up or something. But we cut it out because we felt like it was too, just a little too much. Yeah.
I'm talking with designers involved in the production of the 39 Steps at Perseverance Theater, Art Roach, Valerie Snyder, and Riley Whitford. And it's been a successful show and is a lot of fun for the audience as well, and it's so successful it's been extended.
Yeah, we've added four more performances October 20th through the 23rd, so it now closes with a 2 o'clock matinee on Sunday the 23rd. One of the performances Thursday the 20th is Pay As You Can, and all the tickets will be at the door, so there's no advance purchase for those. So the whole house will be available, Pay As You Can, at the door. And then the Friday and Saturday performances on the 21st and the 22nd are at 7:30, and they're the usual Friday and Saturday pricing. So those tickets for Friday, Saturday, and then the Sunday matinee are available online at perseverancetheater.org or jahc.org, or you can call 463-TIXS and get them in advance.
All right, Art Roach, Valerie Snyder, and Riley Woodford, thank you so much for coming down to the station and talking about the 39 Steps.
Sure. Thank you, Jeff.
Hey, you! Don't watch that! Watch this! This is the heavy, heavy monster sound! The nuttiest sound around! So if you're coming off the street and you're beginning to feel the heat, well, listen, Buster, you better start to move your feet to the rockin'est, rock-steady beat of madness! One step beyond! We'll be right back.
3:46, a little bit of music from the group called Madness. You're tuned to KTOO News in Juneau here on a Juneau afternoon. Now we're going to go to the movies with Clint Farr and Pat Race and talk about some of people's favorite movies. We have had a couple of people call in with their list of favorites, and Pat and Cliff are going to do that a little bit more.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we looks like we had somebody submit sort of a treatise here on Rabbit Proof Friends. So maybe I should just read it for you?
Yeah.
Okay. All right. So per your invitation, here are a couple of thoughts on watchable movies. By the way, this is from listener Jerry. Be advised that my thoughts are off the top of my head. They are not scholarly expressions based on historic, stylistic, artistic accuracy. Well, that's good.
That's our theme.
That's our theme. Yeah, we wouldn't want that. Arguments may abound. I'm all ears. So last time I left off with the mention of Rabbit Proof Friends. This is an Australian movie about the Aborigines in the Australian outback. It takes place in the 1930s. Three Aboriginal girls are taken from their families and put into white dresses in a state school for re-education 1,000 miles to the south of their family lands. Kenneth Branagh does a wonderful job as the tightly wound, black-suited, white-shirted schoolmaster. They escape and make their way home along the rabbit-proof fence that runs the length of Australia from south to north. The whole story is their effort to get home while being pursued by agents of the schoolmaster. I take note of this movie because it is almost entirely free of dialogue. The power of the movie is conveyed against the desolate outback through gesture, expression, silence, and careful cinematography and casting. The beauty of it is conveyed at the end of the movie by the introduction of two of the three girls, now very elderly and very cheerful in their home territory. Left unsaid was the fate of the third girl, who was recaptured during the escape and never heard from again. And then he had a couple other movies, Used Cars and World's Fastest Indian. And I have to say, I have seen Rabbit Proof Fence, and I don't know if you two have seen
this. I haven't
one
seen
yet.
It, but from the, I've heard great things about it. And from the description, it sounds like something that could have taken place here in Alaska.
Yes.
Which is, I mean, that's what really makes it interesting to me.
Yeah. It is a very good movie. It's also kind of emotionally a draining. One of those very draining films.
Really, it sounded kind of peppy and upbeat.
I think of it a moose proof fence.
Yeah. Moose proof fence, yes, that runs the length of Alaska. Isn't that the pipeline? No, they rub up against it to stay warm. It reminds me a lot of, it doesn't remind me, but an emotional wallop. I don't know if any of you guys have seen Iris with Kate Winslet and Jim Broadbent. That was like getting your heart ripped out of your chest and stomped on repeatedly.
I don't watch a lot of movies, actually. I don't even know why I'm here.
He just makes it up.
All right. Then your turn, Pat.
No, that's great.
Thank you, Jerry.
I'm excited to see that film. That sounds great.
Yeah,
I like films that don't
really
have
good.
A lot of dialogue, and I really enjoyed, like, in the first half of WALL-E, when they had, it was just kind of this poetic little robot motoring around, and it didn't matter that there was no dialogue. It was just beautiful.
Right.
It's not always necessary, and sometimes it detracts if it's bad dialogue.
Well, what is it? You go to a film school, and they always say that a good movie you can follow without sound,
mm-hmm.
because it is a purely visual media.
Yeah, I actually I've spent the last 3 years on the regional selection committee for the Student Academy Awards, and so we watch a lot of short films there. And a lot of times they start out and they're really, really, really amazing.
Uh-huh.
And then when they start talking, they just go south. And so sometimes using no dialogue is a way to get around bad dialogue.
Right. That's a good point. Yeah.
Well, a few weeks ago when Clint and Pat were on the air, we put out the call for people to call up and leave a message on my answer machine to with their favorite movie. So we have one now. This is an anonymous person, but we're going to play it anyway.
Top 5 movies of all time in no particular order. Flash Gordon, Raising Arizona, the Coen Brother movie, Reservoir Dogs, Deer Hunter, and School of Rock. I love School of Rock. I can watch it with my 6-year-old daughter, and I love the music in it. This is an anonymous caller.
All right, so what do you think about that?
That's a great list. Go ahead, Pat.
Yeah, no, that sounds awesome. I really like that he could find something that he could identify with and also enjoy with his kid.
I mean,
that's like the ideal film, is something that you can really invest in, but you can also share with someone that, you know, isn't even in the same generation.
Right. Do you remember the director of School of Rock? Is it Linklater?
It may be. I don't remember.
Yeah. Richard Linklater. He did that.
We should have a computer in front of us so we can cheat.
I know. Yeah. We can bring up IMDb. Raising Arizona. I just want to talk a little bit. He brought up Raising Arizona. Is the only movie in which I can tolerate Nicolas Cage. So that's saying something. See, it's a pretty amazing film. It's a...
you really don't like Nicolas Cage. I liked him in Kick-Ass. Kick-Ass is a great
that
film.
That was a great movie. That's true. But he had a bit part in that.
Yeah. Well,
sort of the
main character.
All right, fine.
Okay. Actually, if I can hijack things for a second, I'm sure everyone's been embarrassing you about this, but I want to say congratulations on your Arts
that's
Award,
true.
Jeff.
That's
that's outstanding. And as someone who... Like, I make short films and things like that, but part of the reason I do that is because when I was a kid, I was like this weird little, I don't know, 12-year-old running around Juneau eating pizza at Bullwinkle's, and I'd look in the display case there, and there would be these strange things like keyboards that had a board with keys on it, like that you'd use to open a door, and all these little strange things that had been glued and cobbled together, and that kind of stuff really helped inspire me to say, like, hey, it's okay to, like, make your own stuff and be creative and have fun. So I think it's great that you got that award, and I think I'm really excited about it. So congratulations.
Thank you. It's amazing what a little bit of hot air can do.
Yeah.
Well, should we go to another caller?
Sure.
This is Rick Romarin. I'm a huge fan of movies, and so it's very difficult to pick the top five. But just off the top of my head, I'll start with 2001. I saw this on a huge Cinerama screen in Seattle as a kid when it came out. It's hard to pick one Kubrick film, but this is as close to cinematic perfection as any film I've ever seen. The Wizard of Oz, the flying monkeys still terrify me. Castle Keep, it's a quirky and amusing anti-war film with some great stars, including Peter Falk, who decides baking bread is preferable to killing. Brazil, some of the things depicted in this dystopian view of the future have already come to pass, and I'll wrap things up with Rashomon. It's a Kurosawa classic I could watch again and again.
All right, what do you guys think of that?
That's a really eclectic mix. It's great, though. There's some really good films on there. I like that he brought in Brazil. I'm a huge fan of all Terry Gilliam's films, and that one is just so strange. I haven't actually seen it as an adult. I feel like I watched it as a kid, and it just kind of blew my mind. I need to reapproach that one.
Yeah, you got to be careful with that, watching a movie as an adult. You know how disappointing E.T. was when I watched it as an adult.
Really?
When I was a kid.
Oh, no, I loved it.
I saw it as a kid, though, and it was like, it made me cry so hard. It's like I'd been shot or something. I was just like bawling, and then it was just an emotional thing, and then I remember that, and then when I saw it as an adult, it wasn't there, but of course I'm now
you're
jaded.
You're a callous
I'm
man.
Callous,
yeah.
You know, you grow up and you
well,
become jaded. And
I mean,
callous.
Nothing moves you. That's, you're a rock, Clint.
Especially when it comes to E.T.
Well, let's try something experimental. Let's go to the telephone lines, and this is a new phone number for people. It's, we haven't been describing it yet. It's 463-6455. That's 463-6455. If you have a list of your top five movies, then you have to kind of explain your way out of that if you can. So it's 463-6455. And while we're waiting for a call, if one appears, then we'll talk a little bit more about your favorite movies, Clint.
Sure. It's funny you brought up Wizard of Oz because I was thinking about showing that to my kids.
Mm-hmm.
But the monkey scene, I'm not sure.
It's like a rite of passage. We're all supposed to be terrified by that. It's been formative. I mean, you turned out okay.
That's debatable. I did come up with some some feel-good movies, though. Not feel-good, just enjoyable movies. I was thinking about Say Anything from 1989.
Yeah,
and
John Cusack. Who's doing a film in Anchorage.
Yes, right.
Starts filming,
on
I think,
Frozen
on the
Ground.
17th or something like that.
With Nicolas Cage.
Yes, who you love. Yeah. Right, we covered that.
Should
right?
be excellent. Yeah. and Lloyd, John Cusack played this guy Lloyd Dobler, and I remember thinking that God, I think I'm Lloyd Dobler, but he was so self-possessed and confident, even though he was kind of on the outside of things.
That's a very iconic
that
film.
I
too,
was
though.
Not Lloyd Dobler.
You're not. I think I don't know.
I wanted to be.
That's
Lloyd
one
Dobler.
Of those movies that everyone can,
yeah.
an adolescent male can really invest in
yeah.
and feel like they are.
Yeah.
part of that story.
Yeah. No, that was if folks, especially the young folks that haven't seen that one yet, that's one's probably worth your rental. And then again, I'm trying to think of rentals. Do you have any, Pat?
Oh, yeah. Actually, I was thinking that because it's October, I was like, oh, what's a movie this October? October Sky is one of my favorite films. And it's this film about a kid. It's actually Jake Gyllenhaal. I think maybe one of his early films. He's plays like a teenage kid and lives in a coal mining town. His dad works at the mine, and he's underground all day. And this is when Sputnik is launched. And so It's this thing where his dad's underground in the dark all day, and he's kind of got his eyes to the sky, and he gets really excited about rocketry, and he's building all these like model rockets and blowing things up in the backyard, and his dad wants him to come work in the mine and get a real job and get his head out of the clouds, and it's this battle between what he really loves and what his passions are and what his mind is drawn to and sort of the practical get a job and dig in the dirt and make your way in the world, and it's a really beautiful story.
Good deal. I've not seen it. Thank you.
Yeah,
that might be one to rent.
Mm-hmm.
Thanks.
That's why I suggest.
That's right. School of Rock was mentioned in one of the previous callers, and I believe that was directed by Richard Linklater. And if it was, I actually had Dazed and Confused down.
Yeah, that's fantastic.
As a must rent at some point if you haven't seen it. Most people have seen it, but if you haven't, it's one that you need to get. I don't know if I've ever seen a movie that quite captures, outside of Say Anything, in a different way, but a movie that quite captures that sort of late teen, on the verge of adulthood,
freedom.
Yeah, you
have some very good coming-of-age films here. Are you going through a midlife crisis?
I might be.
Okay.
No. No, I'm a rock. What are you talking about? So Dazed and Confused was one, and then a couple of just crazy films. The very first film my daughter, Carmen, saw at the age of 2 was Shaun of the Dead.
Wow.
Yeah. She was 2 days old.
I can't wait to see what that does to a child.
I don't know if it does anything when you're two days old, but it was the perfect film for 2 days after giving birth to a child.
That's great.
Yeah, yeah.
All right, Clint Farr and Pat Race, thank you very much for coming down the station today.
Done. Okay.
Talking about movies, we could do it again. If you ever got a list of 5 favorite movies, you can call my answer machine and leave a message, and we'll try to put them on the air in the future here. 463-6425 is my telephone number.
Thanks for calling in.
Yeah, thanks.
Sorry, Beth.
Time is 3:58, and you are tuned to KTOO News in Juneau. This is a little bit of music of Tavaka. They'll be appearing in concert this Sunday, October 16th, at the Juneau Douglas High School Auditorium. Tickets are available through the Juneau Arts and Humanities Council website. KTOO broadcasts at 104.3 FM in downtown Juneau and Douglas. KTOO also broadcasts on these translators. In the Valley and North Bay area, tune to K276 AF at 103.1. In Lemon and Swartz Creek, K269 AO at 101.7. Gustavus listens on K201 AM 88.1. K220BT serves Huna at 91.9. In Excursion Inlet and Icy Strait, you can hear KTOO on K210 AS 89.9. Also online at www.kto.org. We have tomorrow 3 on a Juneau afternoon. We'll find out about Saturday's Llama Llama Party with Katrina Pearson from Heartside Books. Nicole Hollingstein will give us the details on Saturday's Women's Health Forum at Centennial Hall. For the preview of next week's Alaska Day Ball with guests Fred Thorstenson, Lorinda Kastner, and Karen Benet Peterson. We'll also talk with visiting yoga instructor Les Leventhal, and Nancy DeTourney will be here with news and views about local art activities during Arts Up tomorrow 3 here on KTOO News. The forecast for tonight, rain showers, low temperatures around 40 degrees. Forecast for Thursday, rain showers becoming scattered in the afternoon with high temperatures around 47 degrees. Forecast for Thursday night, mostly cloudy skies with scattered rain showers. Isolated rain showers expected on Friday, otherwise mostly cloudy skies. And we have next is All Things Considered. Thank you for tuning in to a June afternoon today. Have a good evening. Matango, betong.